Hello, welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns, and my guest today is a high-level international mountain guide with massive experience of climbing Everest, and he's also an author who's just about to produce his fourth book. And I want to fascinated to talk to Robert because I really want to know what he's learned about people, I guess, and about the mountains in his career. So I'll just introduce Robert Anderson. Hello, Robert.
Hello there.
Hi there. Now, I wanted to ask you, what first got you into mountains and climbing?
I think I was very fortunate because I grew up in Colorado in the middle of the Rocky Mountains. And I still remember it vividly. We were driving above Boulder once with my family when I was probably in my early teens or so, and I saw somebody rock climbing, and I'd never really imagined that people went straight up rock faces like that. And it was really, I think, a sense of magic that I had and a touch of something you could do in life that was completely different. And I think the good thing about it is I've kind of maintained that idea that it's a little bit magic to be able to go up to high places as long as I've lived, really.
And so what sort of was your first most memorable climb then? Where did you go with that?
I think the rock climbs that I did right around in Colorado, particularly in El Dorado Springs, there's some very famous routes up there, the Naked Edge, and we did new routes up on the Diamond in Colorado, and then I moved on and climbed El Cap in Yosemite Valley and did a route on that, the Salathe Wall, which has obviously become much more popular lately with Alex Honnold doing free solo. And just kept going from there. And then I first really went on my big expedition out internationally with a team from the UK and went down to South America and climbed in the Andes in Peru and did Huascarán and some of the peaks in that area.
And when did you first go to the Himalayas?
I was invited to go to the Himalayas in 1984 by somebody who I actually worked for. He had a mountaineering company, and I worked for him for a couple of years before I left the U.S. and moved to New Zealand. And he phoned me up in New Zealand, of all places, and basically said, do you want to go climb Everest? And I think, like any crazy climber, I said, of course I do. I can't believe that. And so I went off on that first expedition in 1985, a very long time ago. And I was really fortunate because it was a year when Dick Bast was there and completed his seven summits, which is the first time that somebody done all the speak on every continent. Chris Bonington was there, and I met him for the first time and shared base camp together. So it was a really kind of great grounding, that's where I start my book, Nine Lives, is literally ground zero at base camp in 1985 on Everest.
And so you were really part of this big mountaineering community then?
Well, I was part of it and then I wasn't, because I lived in New Zealand. So I was always working from overseas and living over there. So the people I got to know early on were more people who, sadly, I guess there's been quite a few of those that have died in the time that I've been climbing, Gary Ball and Rob Hall down in New Zealand. I got to know Ed Hillary very well. He became quite a good friend, and I still now climb and talk with Peter Hillary quite frequently.
So you really did get to know some of the sort of top names in climbing. And were they keen to sort of impart a lot of knowledge to you?
Yeah, they've always been very, very helpful. Through the years, I was so fortunate to meet Chris Bonington all that those many years ago. And then when we put together an expedition a few years later to climb a new route on Everest and do the Kangshung Face, I was fortunate to meet John Hunt, who is the expedition leader in 1953, who really, really helped out quite a lot with how I built the team, put everybody together, and then led the group that went over and did the new route on the Kangshung Face of Everest.
Right, and do you think that people who are committed to climbing at that level, as many of those people that are, is there something different about those people, do you think?
Yeah, I'd say there is. It's more about, I think, doing the new routes too, which makes it different, because if you're following routes that are already established, you're very much going up to see if you can compare to other people. Are you better or perhaps worse than they are as climbers? and it's more competition. When you're going to a mountain and it hasn't been climbed, or the route you want to do hasn't been climbed, you have to look at it. It's almost, I might say, artistic in some ways, because you have to read the mountain and you interact with the mountain, and the team becomes less important, even though you might be working with people and climbing with other people. So it's a much different experience and takes a whole nother level of experience to go up and do new routes and climb at that kind of higher level.
So the people who are, if you like, sort of pushing the frontiers, are maybe need an extra bit of drive, or I suppose commitment, really? You think that's true?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of everything. It's drive, commitment. Some people say it's just, you know, the adrenaline. I'm not sure it's so much of that. It's very much a mix. And I think we come back and we tell the stories. And certainly I've got a few of them in my book about nearly dying. But it's the times you remember, which is the other 95% of, you know, brilliant, brilliant sunrises and sunsets, great days of climbing, you know, hard moves done on routes where you didn't think you were going to quite make it, but you managed to scrape through and get up anyway. So it's more the highlights than the lowlights that kind of shine through when you come back. And I've never found anything quite like it.
And is it true that you nearly died on your first attempt on Everest? Is that right?
Yeah, it's the theme of the book is pretty true, and with Nine Lives, because I realized when I'd come back from that one that it quite a large rock fall had happened and come down, and if I hadn't really gotten out of the way very quickly, it would have definitely killed me. Right. And I realized then how dangerous it was, and then I followed that up a few years later by going on the Kangshung face, and I've never actually gone back and counted up the lives I've had. But I think I might have used up quite a few more than one or two on that second expedition to the Kangshung face when we went and climbed with Stephen Venables and became the first British guy to climb up to the top of Everest without oxygen.
Right. Okay. So, So you may have actually expended considerably more than nine lives by the sound of it.
I could have, perhaps. I hope not. I don't want to have used them up quite yet.
And what... I mean, you must know. You probably know Everest perhaps better than pretty well anyone around, really. What captivates you about Everest?
I think when I first went there, we were fortunate in some ways that we were on a very difficult route. As much as Everest is known for not being particularly difficult, having a lot of people, my earlier experiences were that it can certainly be very, very difficult and interesting climbing, and if you're going to those sides of the mountains, or if you're going in other seasons, there's virtually nobody there. So the climbing can be magnificent. If you have a good day on Everest, it's kind of one of the best days climbing you'll ever have. And there's certainly a lot of, you know, very good high standard climbing that we found there on the mountain.
So it sounds like it actually offers quite a lot in different ways of challenge. You hear about, obviously, you know, days when hundreds of people summit, which is obviously very, you know, got up the, I suppose, what you have to call a tourist route in a way. But obviously there's a lot more to the mountain than that.
Yeah, there is. And then as much as it is the tourist route, that's the route that I've guided a couple of times. It's still a magnificent climb. I think that, the tourist route is probably one of the finest climbs in the world. It really is magnificent. You know, you go up through the ice fall, all the way through the area called the Valley of Silence, that I think they kind of named that right in the early expeditions. You know, you go way up a very big ice space and you're on the South Pole, kind of considered the highest and one of the most unpleasant camping grounds in the world. And then you go out to the top and you haven't slept much when you get up there and you go all the way to the summit. It's a fantastic route. And one of the best things about it is the summit ridge does not disappoint. You know, it's a few thousand meters down one side and a few extra thousand meters down the other side, and you're walking along an absolute knife edge cornice ridge that drops off, and usually it's just after sunrise when you're there, and you go on up to the top of the world. So it's really a fantastic final couple of hours with the sun coming up. It's just, you know, it's really unmatched anywhere in the world. It's incredible.
It does sound an amazing experience. Yeah, it does. Even though, you know, it's perhaps slightly tainted with the commercial aspect of it. You know, your description of it makes you realize what a fantastic mountain it is. When you're guiding groups, you're often guiding people who are perhaps have limited mountaineering experience. and are obviously facing what is probably the, what's undoubtedly, I would guess, the biggest challenge of their lives. And you must have learned quite a bit about how to bring teams together under those situations. How do you do that? How do you bring a group of folk who perhaps don't even know each other very well together to face up to an incredible challenge like that?
I think one of the things that perhaps makes it easier is that, unlike business, when you're going to Everest, it's a pretty single-minded, solitary goal. So you've got everybody's pretty much headed in the right direction. There's not much discussion about where you're going. Of course, how you do it becomes obviously very, very important in the tactics you use. And, you know, so much now is it's become such an individual experience on Everest. So it's, you know, it used to be, well, if we get one person up or a few people up, the expedition has been successful. And now it's very much, I have to get up. So it's become more of an I and an individual challenge than a team group. But at the same time, you're often climbing together with people. Luckily, a lot of climbers share, you know, very similar kind of outlooks on life and characteristics, and, you know, can be very, very helpful in themselves. I think one of the things I do is I really work with people to kind of make them look at the bigger picture. And I have an iconic holograph kind of thing that has kind of the sky at the top and then the earth in the middle and then a picture of the team and yourself. And it's really about starting and thinking about what the bigger picture is, then mm-hmm. coming a bit closer, looking at the terrain and the challenges you face, finally sharing those thoughts and working with the team. And then at the bottom of the whole kind of pyramid is, why don't you have a look at yourself and see what you're doing and how, you know, you can help everybody work together better. So there's quite a few different ways, which also are applicable to business.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can take them in and have training seminars around much the same kind of things, because they're human characteristics. They're not climbing characteristics.
Yeah. But you must obviously have encountered times when people have been close to giving up and you've had to try and keep them going. How do you approach that?
A lot of times, particularly over the time of the expedition, you've hopefully built up quite a bit of faith and people put quite a lot of trust in you, really. And if you encourage them and get used to climbing with them and get a sense for what they're good at, you have a real sense of what they can and they can't do. And it's very much an individual thing. You certainly wouldn't encourage a group of people the same way you'd encourage one person who is not having a good day or things. A lot of this I do in advance, and I talk about you can become very emotional at altitude, and you can have good days when you think you can climb anything, and you can have bad days when you don't think you can climb anything, but you still actually feel okay and you're doing fine. So a lot of it is really getting a sense for what people are capable of, and then encourage them at the right points of time. I think there's also the other challenge, John, where you get people who are, they don't need any motivation or encouragement, and actually they're going too far, and you have to, you know, get them to slow down a bit, or to take their time, or to, you know, just make sure that the safety of the group and the team is paramount in what they're doing.
Right. Okay. And what does it mean to you and to the people you're with to actually manage to get to the summit of Everest?
I think I met a man early on in my career who had a company called Jagged Globe, which is still the company I guide for, Steve Bell. And he said, there's very much a before Everest and an after Everest life. And I think he summed it up so well. And it's kind of before that, it's such an absolute getting to the top of Everest, which is quite unique in life. So many things now are you kind of do it, or you make a bit of money, or things are quite successful, but it's not like I did it. And the thing about Everest is you either do it or you don't do it. And that sense of having an absolute, which is in many circles, quite well-respected accomplishment, it's a great sense of accomplishment to get up to the top of Everest.
Right, yeah, I can imagine it is. And obviously, you've been inspired to write a number of books. You've written, this is your fourth book, Nine Lives, I'm right in saying, yeah, am I?
Right, yeah.
So where did you start? When did you begin writing?
Well, I started riding about the same time I started climbing, actually, and I was always interested and took a lot of English classes. I think I published my article in about climbing in, you know, when I about the same time I was, you know, probably 17 or 18 years old. And I always found a pretty good audience for my work. And I trained, I did a degree in English writing as well.
Oh, okay. Literature.
So I had some more formal training. And then I got into advertising, which is, you know, I like to describe as capitalist poetry. But
I like that.
It is an art form in itself, and you certainly get to do a lot of writing. And I, through my career, I moved up until I was an executive creative director. So I was working with a lot of teams, and more of what I was doing was akin to being an editor or perhaps a bit of an inspiration to come up with the ideas for advertising. So I've always been a writer, and I've been able to write a lot. I think my earlier books, they came out of, I always wanted to write one, and I was very fortunate. I had an amazing literary agent in New Zealand, and he went in and I managed to get him to come around and see me and took him through my slideshow and talked to him. And he said, "I don't think you have one book, Robert. I think you have two." So I must be one of the few authors in the world who pretty much had an agent who immediately went out and sold two books for me, basically on the Seven Summits. And the other area I think is I really enjoy writing books. People talk about writer's block and looking for inspiration. Mm-hmm. And all that, and maybe it's been trained out of me, because if you're writing soap ads, you don't have the time to wait for inspiration or do something. You got to sit down and you have to write very well, and you have to have ideas, and you have to tell the story. And it's something that I think I'm never happier in some sense, besides being in the mountains or flying my paraglider, than if I'm sitting down to write. You know, that's what I really enjoy. So working on books and then being able to, you know, write one more with Nine Lives has been a great, you know, last couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, I always think that for a writer, in some ways, mountaineering is a bit of a gift, because climbing a mountain is by definition a story, and it's kind of got its own structure. You start at the bottom and you somehow get to the top, or you don't get to the top, and the end is there's always a tension, because the end is always in doubt. Is that the way you found it in writing?
Very much so. And that's a really interesting kind of way of looking at it. And it's something that certainly my first couple of books went through. And they started the beginning of the story, and we raised some money and we packed some stuff. And we put together a team and we went off and we, you know, struggled with our porters, and we got to the mountain and we bonded as a team, and we shared difficulties and challenges, and we, you know, miraculously summited somewhere towards the end. And then we like came back and lived happily ever after. And that's a great one. And then I've read so many books. I've quite a good library, I think, of mountaineering books, and particularly Everest books. And so when I was looking at Nine Lives, I was like, what is the moment in time? What is the thing that defines an expedition? And what defines like 9 or 10 expeditions to Everest? And it was, you know, kind of that moment. And a friend of mine shared, it's like, God, you've been there so many times, Robert. It's like you have nine lives. And so I kind of ran with that. And so I literally started writing the book 10 or 15 years ago. I had a lot of the notes and stuff for it. And it was just focused on those kind of moments in time when I nearly died, as opposed to, you know, all the rest of the things that you normally find in an expedition. It was just that little snapshot and then building out chapters around those moments.
Ah, right. So what you've done, rather than just tell the whole story of it, what you've done is you've focused on, I suppose, the crucial and critical points that you've experienced on the mountain and looked at those. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. I very much kind of, like we mentioned that first time when I just about got killed on the mountain, basically. And I talk about the fact each chapter has a little bit of an overall theme. And I call that first one, Life is Intuition.
Uh-huh,
and the reason I managed to survive that moment was I'd been doing a lot of climbing. I'd been in a lot of dangerous situations. And when things started to happen, I had enough experience that I just did the right thing intuitively. If I would have sat around and thought, what am I going to do? How am I going to avoid this rock fall? I never would have come out of there. But I just moved and shaked and did things right away.
Yeah. Okay. And... okay, so your book comes out in November, am I right?
Yep, that's right, November 5th,
Okay. Oh, but the book is actually, well, I understand that you can actually pre-order the book right now, but it's actually published, and I think in early November at some time.
And right. Yeah.
So what do you think that you have you got this this climbing disease out of your bloodstream yet, or are there still things that you really want to do?
Oh no, I've been not disappointed. I've actually had such an amazing year last year and the year before. I've been spending the northern winters down in Antarctica, which of course is summer down there, guiding for Antarctic Logistics. It's an amazing company, and they bring about probably 25 or 30 guides down every year. So I've been doing that because that's just a magical continent, and I'd love to go back down there again. Obviously, we're not doing that this year.
No.
I think one more round that's certainly in me on Everest. If anything, I think I've got more time now, kind of retired from my advertising career, and I'm writing and doing a few lectures and working as a consultant occasionally. So I can climb and paraglide and write books. So I've got trips to Everest planned next spring, if I can do that, guiding with Jagged Globe, in the summer out in the Karakoram and up into the K2 region there.
Right.
And perhaps climbing. In the fall, there's an area of Nepal called, I always confuse it, Upper Dolpo, Outer Dolpo. Anyway, it's where Peter Matheson went when he wrote the Snow Leopard book. And it's just a remote and wild part of, it's in Nepal, but it's basically up on the Tibetan Plateau, and I'm leading a group out there. So I think I'm going to be doing things in the mountains for a long, long time, I'd say.
It sounds like it. It sounds like your passion for the hills and for the mountains is still very much alive, which is great to hear, really. Okay, well, thanks very much for talking to me. I really hope that Nine Lives does well. I'm really looking forward to reading it when it comes out, and perhaps we can get together again and talk about the book when it comes out.
Yeah, that'd be great. I was thinking one thing about these books is, you always, nowadays, it's like you got to encourage your friends to write reviews, and then people read your reviews, and hopefully they're half decent, and encourages them to buy the book. And I'm thinking, I really want to write a review on my own book, because my last couple of books, when I wrote them, the reviews extended from, this is like one of the best things ever written on climbing literature, and it compares with the classics of the genre, to not quite this, but basically it's not worth the paper it's printed on. It's quite interesting, the range of things. And certainly there's things when you get a book as a writer, and you'd know this, John, you go back and you look at it and you're like, oh, I really, really shouldn't have written it like that.
Yeah,
I could have edited that part, or, oh my gosh, everybody talks about this and I had so much more to say. So I think authors can be very good reviewers of their own books. And I think I'll be thinking about that as the book kind of gets out there in the marketplace and people start commenting on it. And I'll have those thoughts. So it'd be great to talk to you again, and we can do a review of my own book.
No one's ever asked me to do that. That has to be an interesting. We'll do a review of your own book when it comes out in November. Okay.
That'd be great. It's a real pleasure talking to you. Fantastic.
Pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much, Robert.
Okay. Thank you, John.
And that was Robert Anderson talking about his book Nine Lives, which is currently available to pre-order from Vertebrate Publishing and will be out in November. Just to tell you about a couple of little things I have got coming up, I'm going to be interviewing fairly shortly climber, journalist and translator Natalie Berry, to talk about her translation of Elizabeth Revol's book To Live. I want to be really interesting to talk to her to get a sort of female perspective on that kind of level of climbing and indeed what it was like to translate the book. And also I'm trying to get, he hasn't agreed yet, but he will, farmer and rewilder Derek Gow on the show. So I'm hoping to interview him fairly shortly to get his take on environmental issues and talk about his book about reintroducing the beaver. So I've been John Burns. I really hope you've enjoyed Outside In, and I hope to see you again. Bye-bye.